James chapter 4. If you don't have a Bible, some of our ushers are coming out. They will give you one. If you don't own a Bible, just take that home with you. That is our gift to you. Great to give those out. We keep on buying more, so that's a good sign, I think. I think people are probably taking Bibles for the right reasons. I certainly hope they are. So if you need a Bible, take that. Or if you have a big Bible with lots of these and thous and heretofores and things like that, and it creaks when you open it, take one of these too. It's a little easier to put in your purse or your backpack or whatever you use to get around town. If you've been a part of this ministry, you know that we've been teaching through Mark's gospel pretty much off and on for the last year or so. We've been walking through in the fall through Mark, and we will get back into Mark next week with the launch, the relaunch of our small group communities. We will start those up next week. And so we will get back into Mark next week. If you're not a part of a small group community, I encourage you, get involved in a small group community. Great chance to get to know people, great chance to learn, great chance to walk through passages, ask questions, great chance to serve others, all sorts of things. Again, they start next week. Lots of different opportunities. We are starting an additional small group on Thursday nights next week as well. So if maybe Thursday nights is the only night that works for you, there's another one that's starting up. We will have a bunch of information in terms of times and dates and places and people and all of that next Sunday. But I encourage you, make the time for those. They are a key part of what we're doing here as a ministry. We are in James chapter 4. All I want to do is I want to kind of fire through about five verses with you, starting at verse 13 of James chapter 4. Let me tell you the reason why I want to do this. Part of the reason is because it's a new year, and with new year, the start of new year stuff, we usually make goals and plans and all of that kind of thing. So there's sort of a theme around the starting of a new year every time we come to this point in the season. And so I want to walk through some stuff in light of that. Also, I guess I want to spend some time maybe reminding you of some things that. And here's my fear as I come into this message, if you want to call it that. And that is, some of what I'm going to talk about this morning is going to seem for some of you rather simple, simplistic, basic, that type of thing. And so I have a bit of a fear in that, but I also know that it's important, I think, to be reminded of those key elements of what makes us who we are as followers of Jesus. And more importantly, how our lives are different in light of the fact that we know Jesus, we have a relationship with him, we believe that God has an intimate desire, a personal involvement in our lives. And so I want to remind you of some of those things in light of that truth. And for some of you, that may be a revelation. Your idea of God is a God way out there who maybe started things, pulled the cord, so to speak, fired things up, but he sort of stands back, kind of watching from afar, that type of God, that type of picture of God. So maybe the very fact that I'm talking about a God who has a desire for intimacy with you, a personal relationship with you, that may be a new concept. So that's great. If that's new to you, awesome. So I want to go in, again, in light of the time of year and in light of wanting to remind you of some basics, some key elements. And I'm okay with that in terms of reminding you of some things that you may know. There's a verse that I always, a couple of verses that I kind of always resonate with me when I think about talking about some things that may seem rather elementary. And this is from Peter's second epistle. Let me just read a couple of verses. In verses 12 and 13 of the first chapter of that epistle, Peter writes this: "So I will always remind you of these things, even though you know them and are firmly established in the truth you now have. I think it is right to refresh your memory as long as I live in the tent of this body." So Peter is basically saying to his audience, hey, you know what? I'm going to remind you of some things. I know you know them. I know you're firmly entrenched in them. But I think it's a good reminder just to kind of key in on them again and again. So that's what I'm going to do a little bit with you. And when we come to this passage in James, James, half-brother of Jesus, the writer of this particular book, for those of you that have studied this letter, it's very practical. It's very applicable. Not that the rest of Scripture is not applicable. Obviously it is. But James is one of those books that you don't even really have to think through how to apply it. It's just there for you. It takes the guesswork out. So James is a very practical, applicable book. And the five verses that we're going to look at in James chapter 4 today, what we will see James do in these five verses is he's going to ask us as the audience, as his readers, to look at life, again, for some of you, maybe in a new and exciting way. And for some of you, it'll be, again, a reminder to you. But as we walk into this new year, 2007, and as we hopefully continue to seek living a life that is holy and pleasing to God, James is going to show us, he's going to show us a way to walk where we don't have to rely on our own vices, our own What is that word I'm looking for? I just had a brain cramp. You know what I'm talking about. Own notions, own wisdom, own knowledge. Email me the word when you find it. Just right-click it, thesaurus. You can fire it off to me. Those types of things. And for some of you, you're trying to do that. You're not trying to walk in your own knowledge, in your own wisdom. And for some of you, you are, and you're thoroughly frustrated. And so James is going to walk through some things for us. And this is going to be, I'm going to try to be so practical with you. I'm going to give you several really cheesy illustrations this morning, okay? That's how bad it's going to be this morning as far as the illustrations, because I don't want anybody walking out of here today going, I don't get that illustration. I don't get what the point of that was. So I'm going to walk through some things really, really basically with you. And what we're going to see in these five verses that James gives us, four things that we need to do to make sure that we include God in our plans as we walk into this new year. If you're taking notes, if you're one of those individuals that loves to take notes, you're a type A personality, you want your margins filled, you want to get the best bang for your buck this morning, then here, let me give you the first way, the first piece of advice, the first truth that James gives us. And that is, if we want to include God in all of our plans, we need to submit to God's sovereignty as we plan. Now, sovereignty, big word, right? You're going, sovereignty, what does that mean? Really simply, to put it in simple form, it's like this. God is all-powerful, and he's all-knowing. Put those together. And that essentially is a definition of sovereignty, that God knows what's going to happen, and God's all-powerful to do whatever he wants. In other words, God does not react. In other words, for those of you that have maybe come across some books that teach something called open theism, which suggests that God is kind of surprised, that God sort of reacts, that God is kind of painted in a corner, it is the exact opposite of that. God is never surprised. God never has to react in a sudden, amazed, perplexed way. God is all-powerful. God is sovereign. And so when we talk about making plans and how we can include God in our plans, how we can follow the direction of God as we walk into this new year, what James says is we need to submit to God's sovereignty, that he's all-powerful, that he is all-knowing as we make those plans. Look at verse 13 of chapter 4 of James. He says this, "Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money." Now, when we talk, for those of you that have grown up in the church, one of the mistakes the church makes, I think, is that it throws out words very easily without many of the people really knowing what the words mean. One of the words that gets tossed out in the church, and you may have heard this before, is the word worldly, or worldliness. Gets talked about. You can't be worldly, right? You hear that. You don't want to be worldly. You live in the world, but you can't be worldly. You don't want to be a person that's worldly-like. And we kind of toss it out there, and we go, okay, now I know that it's a bad thing, but what does it mean? Well, let me give you a definition of worldliness, probably the most specific or distinct definition of worldliness. And worldliness, quite simply, in its most basic form, is holding on to a worldview that excludes God from all of your decisions and plans. So it's going through life, trying to live, again, in your own knowledge, in your own wisdom, with your own direction, and excluding God from all facets of it. That's a worldly view. That's a view that excludes God from everything, and it should be no surprise, and this is where we get really messed up. It should be no surprise that those people that don't know God live lives in such a way that that includes decisions, all decisions that don't have God a part of the process, that don't involve God at all. It shouldn't surprise us. If you don't know God, why would you include him in your process of thinking and decision making? However, it is an oxymoron. It is an impossibility. It is a danger most warned against, that people who are followers of Jesus would make decisions and would not include God in the process. In other words, we are warned against being worldly Christians. It's an oxymoron. And so what we have here by what James says in verse 13 is, and he's talking about a person that would make decisions where they don't include God in the plan at all. The hypothetical speaker in verse 13 is essentially saying, this is my plan, and I'm going to make sure that it happens. I've already figured out the time. I've already figured out where it's going to take place. I know what's going to do, and I know what the result is going to be. And the question we need to ask right here is, where does God play a part in this? Hold on a minute. Does God get a vote at all in this? And I guess my heart's cry for you is asking the same question as you plan ahead for this year. Has God a vote in that? Does he have a vote at all? Have you included him in those plans? See, what I really, this is going to sound harsh to some of you, but there is such arrogance in that statement in verse 13. There's no room for God even to offer an opinion or even to give leadership. There's exclusion there. And what we have is this finite human being in verse 13 making fixed plans as if he or she has total control over every detail of life. But the truth of the matter is we can't control everything. We can't control everything, and there is one simple reason you and I can't make plans like this, and quite simply, it's because, unlike God, we are absolutely dependent upon nature and circumstance in our lives. Whereas God is not dependent upon nature or circumstance or situation at all. Let me just give you, here's cheesy illustration number one. You ready? Awesome. This is good. This is good. Like cheesy illustrations? Are you good with these? All right. These are the kind of illustrations that they put illustrations on that bubble gum, you know? You remember when I went to the bad jokes? You go, oh, man, that's brutal. Right? This is where they should be. Cheesy illustration number one. Let's say I want to take a trip tomorrow. Okay? End of the gathering time today. I make plans. I go buy a plane ticket. I'm going to fly somewhere. I'm going to meet up with someone. I've got a widget I want to sell this person. Right? So I buy a plane ticket. Monday morning, I'm going to fly out of here, go to, let's say, Phoenix. Phoenix is nice. You can play golf all year round. It's a good place to go. Want to meet with a buddy down there. I'm going to sell him some widgets. Convince that I'm going to sell him some widgets. Going to sell him a lot of widgets. He's going to give me some money. I'm going to get the money, fly home, and my life will be changed because I have a bunch of cash. Now, those are good plans. Fine plans, not a problem with any kind of plans sort of like that. But here's the problem. There are a lot of things that need to happen right, correctly for that to take place, right? First of all, I got to be alive tomorrow. Got to be alive tomorrow. Got to be alive, at least got to get to the airport. Could snow, things could be just shut down. Got to get on the plane. Got to hope that the pilot knows what he's doing, can fly me, that he knows where Phoenix is, that I can get in there, that my buddy who's supposed to come pick me up and meet with me, that he's there, that he's alive, and that he likes what I'm selling, that he has the money to pay me, right? A lot of things have to take place. And you say, well, that's normal. That would take place. But you have to understand, we are absolutely dependent upon nature and circumstance and situation. God is not. And when we start thinking that we can put ourselves above that, we become people who are living worldly lives, excluding God from the plans and becoming arrogant in the process. Now, I almost hear some of you right now. You're going, well, Norm, are you talking about not planning ahead, that we shouldn't be people who plan, that we shouldn't be people who have goals, those types of things? I'm not saying that at all. In fact, there are several places in Scripture that I would argue that would say that it is wrong. It is a sin not to plan. Lots of places in Proverbs. Proverbs 6, 6 to 8, I believe, is one of the places. But lots of places that we are encouraged to plan, that it's bad planning not to look ahead, that it's folly not to. So I'm not saying that it's not good to plan. What I am saying is that it is wrong. We are counseled against and encouraged to not make plans and exclude God from the plan making. And that's my encouragement to you. And that's what James says here. James says that we are not to make independent plans that leave God out. Schedule making that doesn't allow for God's review. These plans will never succeed. It's the attitude that says, this is what I'm going to do, period. Here's cheesy illustration number two. You ready? Should have called this cheesy talk or something like that. I have a couple boys, 5 and 3, 5 and a half, 3 and a half, if you really want to be correct with them. 5 and a half, 3 and a half. And one of the things that they enjoy doing or have over their long life is puzzles, making puzzles. One of the things, if you ever buy a puzzle for a three-year-old, you buy puzzles that fit three-year-old puzzle-making abilities, right? You know the ones I'm talking about. They're big, like this, and there's four pieces, right? And it's made out of wood, so there's no way you can cram it in there any other way than the way that it's been created. I love these because, you know, 8 times out of 10, I'm successful in these kind of puzzles. I enjoy these type of puzzles. It's good puzzle making. I cannot stand big puzzles with little pieces. Some people love that stuff, man. They'll spend days, won't leave the house, right? Pajamas on, right? Just them. They just huddle over it. You know, mom wants to clear the table. Don't touch that. We're making puzzles. Eat on the floor. That type of thing, right? You know what you're talking about. Some people love that. They just, million pieces. Just dig. I can't stand that. Can't stand that. But if you're successful in making one of the puzzles, now stay with me, even those of you that are very good at this, there's one thing that the puzzle maker always gives you so you can have some success in the building of these big puzzles. What is it? Thank you. Man, you are with me. That's good. The picture, right? And you're always turning it over. All right, you see kind of a color, there's the sky. All right, let's get all the blue pieces, right? You put them up in that corner so when it kind of gets figured out, when you get all the square, everybody does the outside first, right? Because it's all square around that. Because that's the way you've got to do it. That's the only way you can be successful. Here's the deal. We have a puzzle maker who knows what the final picture is to look like. But we don't have an ability in our own selves to be able to put the pieces together because we don't have that type of knowledge. That's actually not a bad illustration. Actually, that's not bad. Because very, very true. And we get in trouble when we start going through. It's like this, right? You take out the hammer, you got those pieces, and you kind of rip off a little. Yeah, there it goes. It's going right there, right? We try to do that many, many days of our lives. We feel like we're just kind of cramming a piece in there. It's got to fit. It has to fit, right? We're those, and we just, man, that's us. That's us, and we can, in our finite knowledge, do that. There's too many pieces to our lives. If we try to live and make plans in our own power, we get in trouble. That's why we need a puzzle maker. That's why we need someone who knows the end result and how to get there. See, too many people hand God their sort of their life itinerary and say, God, this is my plan. And what James tells us is that we have to have a mindset that is different than that. That type of mindset, quite simply, is a sinful mindset. It's a worldly mindset. And again, it's an arrogant mindset. We need to do our planning in dependence upon God's sovereign direction. That he is all-powerful, that he is in control, that he knows the beginning from the end. As Jesus is described in the book of Revelation, first chapter, first and last, Alpha and Omega. That's our puzzle maker. That's our God. Let me give you a second helpful piece of advice from this passage. First was we need to be dependent upon God's sovereign direction. Here's the second. We need to rely on God's infinite knowledge as we plan. Look at what verse 14 says in this passage. It asks the question, why? You do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? Isn't that great? He's such an encouraging guy. What is your life? You are a mist. You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. James actually, what he does here is he gives two reasons why we need to rely on God's infinite knowledge as we plan. The first is seen in verse 14. Maybe you've already picked it up. Here's the first one. I've highlighted it a little bit, at least touched upon it. Our knowledge is too limited. Our knowledge is just too limited. We don't even know, James says, what tomorrow's going to bring. We don't even know what tomorrow's going to bring. Why are we looking a week, a year in advance, thinking that this is going to exactly take place when God's not even involved in our decision process? The Bible says that we should not talk so confidently about that, that we don't even know what tomorrow is going to bring in our lives. Have you ever been, let me give you another, here's cheesy illustration number three. Actually, number two, I'm not even including in the cheesy illustration. I'm excited about that one now. Have you ever been, maybe this is just me, you get a little bit of my life here. Have you ever been so sure that some money's going to come in, you bought something based on it coming in before you've actually had it, right? Today, right? Like, right? I mean, you hear about some money that's going to come in for some reason, somebody owes you some money or whatever, a deal. Maybe you're a salesman, you think something deal's going to come through, whatever it is, and you go out and you buy that Testarossa, right? Or whatever, all right, beanbag chair, flat screen TV, right? Pair of Armani or whatever. A pair of Armani, they make shoes? Doesn't matter. You're just so confident, but something happens. Deal doesn't go through, money doesn't come in, the check bounces. And all of a sudden, you've bought that thing based on the money coming in. And all of a sudden, the car dies. Transmission, out. Roof starts leaking. Your wife gets pregnant. Whatever it is, right? Something unexpected happens. Money's gone. More expenses. You don't know what's going on. And for some reason, the plans that you had just didn't come through. How did you get into that mess? Well, we get into those messes because we are not God, and we don't see everything that is coming. Let me give you a better illustration because it's from the book of Psalms. Psalm chapter 73, great. If you're going through frustrating times, I encourage you, read through the Psalms. They're just great, great passages, great text in there of people just getting honest. David mostly, but other Psalm writers, just getting honest with God. Psalm 73 is a great one. Maybe it resonates with you somewhat. The psalmist is writing in Psalm 73. Basically, essentially, you put in modern-day language, it's, you know what, God, I'm living for you, man. And you know what? My life's not that great, right? My life is hard. I'm living for you. I'm trying to bring glory to you. And my life right now, to be quite honest with you, is not a bowl of cherries. And even to make it worse, I look it around at all the people that I hang out with that aren't living for you. In fact, they're thumbing their noses at you. They are doing their own thing. They live absolutely unrighteous lives. And you know what? They look great. Healthy, abs of steel, nice robes, camels are all tripped out. I mean, just looking good. Everything looks nice, healthy, good. I mean, just everything's, how come? How come when I'm trying to live for you, my life seems so hard, and these people who are doing absolutely nothing for you, in fact, thumbing their nose at you, doing their own thing, everything seems to be so good in their life. How is that? Here's the answer God gives. I want you to know that those people are living on borrowed time, and they're living on a slippery path. The psalmist responds by saying, I didn't know that. Why? Because we're not God. We don't know in our finite minds what is upcoming. And so when we start making plans, we need to rely on the infinite knowledge of God. That's the whole book of Habakkuk. The whole book. The whole book of Habakkuk is, God, what's going on? Everything seems to be out of sorts. What's happening? God says, you know what? Approaching hoofbeats, man. Things are about to change because I'm in control. That's why the people that teach open theism are nut jobs. Because those books, you might as well rip them out. You might as well. I know nut job's not a nice word. Goofy. Silly. Bad theologians. All right? Whatever. I know that sounds mean and critical, but oh well. It's 2007. It's my New Year's resolution. But that's what it's all about, is God, I don't get it. And God says, you know what? I'm God. I'm in control. That's the end of the book of Job. Why you do this? Why you do this? Why you do this? And God's response is, don't worry about it. I'm God. You're not. I'm in control. And that's why we need to rely on God's infinite knowledge as we make plans, as we walk in, especially this new year. Let me give you another reason why, under this point, why we need to rely on God's infinite knowledge. And number two, or second thing I want to point out, is that our days are limited. Our days are limited. How about that for a joyous 2007 message? Our days are limited. You know what? If you said that to me 20 years ago when I was five, I'm just kidding. Just see if you're listening. If you said to me 20 years ago when I was 20 and I could, you know, when I was in shape and stuff and, you know, I thought I was pretty cool, right, and all that stuff, if you said life is short, I would go, whatever, right, whatever. Okay, yeah, I get it. It's short, right? It's short. Short for you, right? Not short for me, man. I got a lot of living left. It's not short at all. It's funny how things change as you get a little bit older and you double the 20 and the 40. That's me, 40. It's amazing how... Even, and I'm not young, I'm not old. I'm in the middle. I'm hanging on, right? I'm hanging on, right? I'm hanging on, baby. And it's amazing how, boy, you start sensing your mortality, man. That life is, the first 40, gotta be honest, went by really fast. Really fast. And I would think that when I hit 80, if I make it to 80, and if I keep on doing the things I'm doing, probably won't. But if I make 80, I'll probably think these second 40 went really fast too. Life is short. Life is a mist. One of the mistakes that we make, and understand why we make them, is we use words like an old life or a young life. When the fact of the matter is, God has called us to live our lives, and we may be called sooner than later, that life can be shorter than our anticipated plans and endeavors. Life is short. Life is short even if you hit 90 or 100, if you really want to be honest. It goes by fast. One of the things that has become, I know, true in many of your lives, true in our lives, we've experienced here at this ministry, that we're people who are in the prime of their lives, early 20s, going to college, man, one day goes out for a hike. That's it. 23, 24. We've lost someone like that this year. And I don't say that to you know, just be a drag. I say that because our days are numbered. Our days are short. Whether we get 40, 60, 80, or 24 years. I remember I thought 60 was old back in the day. I think 60's young, man. I think 60's young. I hear about someone getting cancer at 60, and I go, that's young. That's young. So our days are limited. We need to make the most of them. And since this is true, we need to rely on God in our planning because he knows what we don't know. He sees every factor. He takes into consideration all possibilities and again gives us the best option. Let me give you another cheesy example. One more. I think I only have one more cheesy example. I don't usually give this many examples and cheesy illustrations, but let's get them all over with on the first Sunday and we'll get back next week. Vancouver, as we know, busy city, and because you may not have noticed this, but we have sometimes a bit of a traffic problem in Vancouver. And if you ever take a trip, maybe from the city to the suburbs or from the suburbs to the city, and you're traveling, maybe at the peak of the day, maybe right in the morning or right at rush hour in the evening, one of the things, if you are, say, for example, heading on the number one eastbound and you got to go over the Portman Bridge, if you are somewhat wise, I would think, you put on the radio to see if the traffic's okay. you know it's going to be backed up, but you want to know if everything is okay. And you turn on a radio station, 1130 CKNW, those ones that you only listen to for a few minutes and then go back to whatever else you're listening to. I'm just kidding. You turn on those radio stations because they have what? Eye in the sky, right? Eyes in the sky. They have helicopters that fly above the city that can look ahead, get a different perspective on things, and warn you about things that are upcoming, right? So they say there's been an accident on the Portman Bridge. Better to take the patella or just stop where you are, wait an hour, and then take off later. And if we are, again, all wise and all discerning, we listen. Since they see things that are from a different perspective and know what lies ahead, seeing things that we don't. And because of that, they are worthy to be listened to. Let me repeat that. They are worthy to be listened to. You see, as we navigate through life, God sees things that we don't. He sees bends in the road. He sees things that clog our path. In making our plans, what God wants us to do is to go to Him and listen to Him and depend upon Him. Let me give you, not an illustration, just an example of, I think, how God, I use this expression, I don't mean to be in any way sacrilegious or demeaning when I say it, I mean it with all my heart. I believe God has our back in this ministry. He has demonstrated that over and over and over again. We don't take that for granted. God's grace and mercy has been abundant to us. And there's a small illustration of this in terms of this last week. As I've said to some of you or many of you, we've been moving into new office space. We were fortunate enough to lease some office space just a few short blocks away from here, 2,300 square feet. We're very excited about it, moved in. Really, really busy time for us because we got to buy a lot of furniture, right? We're trying to figure out where to put the plasma TV, all that kind of stuff, hot tubs and, you know, all that, just a lot of work. And so we've had to do a lot of running around. And you know, just the other day, my wife and I were sort of teaming up to purchase some things for the place. We had to buy a fridge for the kitchen because we want to make sure that we can serve the community, have a place for our staff to throw their, you know, farmer sausage burgers or whatever they bring for lunch. We wanted to buy a kitchen table. We wanted to buy some couches. We have this little kind of living room space that we want people to use for small groups, for counseling, different things like that. So we went running around. I was running around, trying to look for some places to buy some things, talk to people, visited, traveling all over town. Nicole, she went over to IKEA in Richmond. You know what that's like, two small kids, right, running around looking for a kitchen table. They actually have two little warehouse spaces. She has to go to the other place. She's waiting around for an hour and a half, 2 hours, two little kids. That's not a great time in IKEA. So all this stuff, finally they say, sorry, it's not in, and you got to get refunded because we won't hold anything for you. So she's got to do that. I get a call from a place I feel like I've bought my furniture from, my couches. They say, sorry, it's back ordered until end of February. The kitchen the fridge is not coming in. That's back ordered too. All of this stuff. And I remember at the end of the day going, what is going on? This should seem like a simple process. We're not buying expensive stuff. We're just trying to get some stuff in there. This person doesn't know I'm going to share this illustration. He doesn't know how God used him. But I had a meeting on Thursday, late in the afternoon, at the end of this day, very frustrated, want to get this stuff done. He comes in my office, give him a little tour of the place, just going, man, you know, just really frustrated at this, really want to get this in. I don't know what I'm going to do. I got to run around wasting time. I'm supposed to get some other stuff done. We got people joining our staff. I need to get ready for them, those kind of things. I'm telling him all this, and he goes, oh, you know what? Just go to the Brick. I deal with the Brick all the time. They'll give it to you at cost, everything you want. They'll deliver it for you. So I went, really? So I drove down to the Brick, bought everything, saved about $1,500 or $1,000 on what I was going to spend earlier that day. It's a little thing. Some of you would say, coincidence. God. God has our back. God knows things I believe we don't know. I base my life upon it. That's a small illustration, but we've seen it lived out corporately in this ministry, and I know you have in your lives. There's sometimes where God's grace is on our lives, and He's really subtle in how He makes it work. He gives us those little moments of joy where we go, thank you, thank you. There's some things where we want to take matters in our own hands, and He will do all manner of things to make sure that His plans are taken care of, that are followed. Reading through Genesis, New Year, reading through Genesis, the Tower of Babel, that situation, the The call by God is to what? Be fruitful, multiply the earth. The followers, the people living on planet Earth at that time, they want to huddle over, make a tower to heaven. What does God do? I think in his humor, confuses their language, right? Pass me the hammer. Sprechen die Deutsch, right? I got to get out of here, right? Como estás, right? I mean, they just scatter. I think those are times where God goes, look, I want this place filled. I want to multiply it, right? Get out of there. Go, fill it, multiply it. I don't want this. You know, we also see it in the church, Acts. I want you to go out and disciple all the nations, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the end of the earth. What does the church do? They huddle in Jerusalem. What does God do? Through a guy named Saul, he brings persecution. What happens? They scatter. See, I think there's some times where God says, this is what I want you to do. Are you going to do it? And we go, no, I like this, man. This is cozy. This is comfortable. And he intervenes, sometimes very gently, I think sometimes in very gracious, humorous ways. And then sometimes, man, he just goes, watch this. Watch this. Time's running out. Let me finish this up for us. Where are we? Here we are. How do we include God in our plans in 2007? Well, the first is to submit to God's sovereignty. The second is to rely on God's infinite wisdom, and infinite knowledge, which leads to the third, and that is we need to defer to God's will as we plan. Look at verse 15. Instead, here's our counsel. Instead, you, me, us, we ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this. Let me point out two things when it comes to God's will. This is a big topic, confusing topic, books, series. Much has been written on this. Much has been taught, discussed, all of that. But let me just highlight a couple of really simple things when it comes to the will of God, as it is said and spoken of here in verse 50. Number one, make this very clear. God has a will for you. Number two, connected to that, God wants you to know his will. Sometimes I don't think we believe that. John 4:34, very famous statement by Jesus when he said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me. And at the end of his life, in that garden scene, he comes to his father and says, Father, if you could only take this cup from me. But he finishes and says, but not my will, but your will be done. Same instruction to the disciples and how we are to pray. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. How is the will of God done in heaven? Perfectly. There's no discussion. I want to do God's will. We need to live our lives in such a way that we seek to live out the will of God on earth as it is in heaven. That's our call. And God has a will for us. Now, the question that always comes, and I don't have enough time to talk on it, is how do I know what God's will is for me? Now, I don't want to oversimplify this, but I want to at least touch upon it by taking you to a passage, very famous passage. If you want to flip there, you can. It's not going to be on the screen. Romans 12, 1 and 2. Let me walk through this really quickly with you, although it is so good. Romans 12, 1 and 2. Says this, in connection with how do we know what God's will is for us? Let me see if I can answer that for you. Romans 12, 1 and 2 says this, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, then you will be able to test and approve. That's a promise. Test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. What are the things that Paul, in writing this passage, tells us to do in connection with knowing God's will? Let me give you really quick, I'll just bomb through these. Number one, first, we need to remember God's mercy if we are to understand what God's will is for us. What does that mean? It means that if you haven't got a good, saving understanding of the mercy of God on your life through Jesus, then you won't know what God's will is for you because it begins there. So in view of God's mercy, in view of the fact that God has been so merciful on me and on you, it begins there. I think part of the problem is we don't know how sinful we are, how much wrath is poured upon us by God without relationship with Jesus. We think we're pretty good people. We're not. We're not outside of Jesus. We're not. We're not. That's why Jesus had to hang on a cross for us. So in view of the fact that God sent his son and died for us, in view of that mercy, that we deserve the wrath of God on our lives, but it was taken and poured upon Jesus, in view of that, it begins there. Begins there, man. So maybe instead of worrying about whether you should date that person or not, just go back and go, maybe I just need to get a clear understanding on the mercy of God. Then I can go forward and I'll have a clear understanding of whether this person, whether that job, whether that home, whether that trip, whatever. God wants me to be a part of that. It begins there. Remember, in view of God's mercy, in view of God's mercy, begins there, goes on. It says, offer your body as living sacrifices. Oh, I could talk about this. Give me 1 minute to talk about this. Okay? You guys good? You don't have anywhere to go. I got a lot of places I can go. A lot of discussion about worship. Paul spoke on worship a few weeks ago back in December, and so I don't need to go over a lot of it. I did a bang-up job with that. But in terms of worship, what worship is, here's a question you need to ask. If you really want to know who you worship most, the question you need to ask is what thing, what event, what involvement do you make most sacrifices for? In how you answer that, then you will know what you worship highest. Now, I'm not talking about time spent. Obviously, I'm not asking you to sing songs, spiritual songs, for 50 hours a week like you spend maybe at work 50 or 60 hours a week. But it is very possible to live a life in such a way that you sacrifice everything for your job. And that's the thing that you worship most. You sacrifice family, you sacrifice church, you sacrifice involvement in ministry, you sacrifice friends, you sacrifice your kids. That's what you worship most. That's what Paul is saying. Some of you, this is very common in North America, I'm going to step on toes here, that's okay. Some of us worship our kids, man. We sacrifice everything for our kids. Everything. Our kids want to do this, okay, let's put them in that program, even though it's going to take them out of church or involvement in ministry. I know I'm stepping on toes here, baby. That's okay. I got two kids. I'm with you on that. I understand that tension. But when we sacrifice Jesus and ministry to Jesus for our jobs and for our kids. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't have a job, you shouldn't have kids. Have a job. Have a great time, but serve Jesus in your job. Have kids, but point them to Jesus. Doesn't mean they can't be involved in things. Get them involved in things. But if those things take precedence all the time, you're serving your kids, man. You're worshiping your kids. Some of you do it with relationships. I have been a youth pastor for 14 years before I did this. I've had so many countless conversations with people say, you know, I'm dating a non-Christian. Is that a bad deal? I'm a follower of Jesus. And I said, help me understand this. Help me understand this. How does this work? Is there tension? Yes, there's tension. I got to make concessions. Okay, do you see that as a good thing when you got to make concessions? No, I don't see that as a good thing, but I have a relationship with them. And I counsel that it's only going to create more problems, not less. It's going to be hard. My counsel is always the same. They say, Norm, if I'm a Christian, say I only date and marry Christians. My counsel is this. No, you got to marry someone who loves Jesus. Marrying just a Christian is not good enough, man. There's a lot of goofy Christians out there. You got to marry someone that loves Jesus. You got to date someone that loves Jesus. But we make concessions. Why? Because we're worshiping that relationship. For some of you, this is the last time you're going to be here. Good to have you. We do it, and you know what? I've made the most mistakes in my life. You know who I have worshipped more and fail often in? Me. Me. Making sure that I'm okay, that my needs are met. that I'm comfortable, that I get that. Right? I do that all the time, man. I am the worst at that. I am the worst at that. I get that. So I'm with you. I'm sitting in the audience looking at me going, guilty. We need to move on. You're going, move on, Funk. Let's go. All right. A couple more really quick. Do not conform to the pattern of the world. I could talk about that. I'm not going to talk about that. Let me just say this. All right? Let me just say this. I haven't really spoken for about 3 weeks, so I'm fired up, man. You know how we think conformity? We read that verse. You know, don't drink beer. Don't smoke, right? Don't listen to non-Christian music. Don't get a tattoo. And if you don't do those things, you won't be conforming to the world. I mean, that's what most people would say in connection with that verse. Bad, bad teaching. Because the conformity as talked in context with this passage is mindset. Because he says, how do we change conformity to the world? We are transformed by the renewing of our minds. You know how we conform to the world? And this is the connection with making plans, and we'll get back to James, I promise. This is how we bring this back to how we include God in our plans and follow God as we live our lives. We make decisions in our lives because we are so conformed to this world, we don't even think and to ask whether this is a good thing or not. Because everybody else is doing it, and it's good stuff. So we just think, this is normal. This is right. I need to purchase that. I need to put my kids there. I need to do this. I need to travel there. I need to save this. And you know what? None of those are bad things. You may be totally freed up to do that. And that's great if you are. God bless you. That is a good thing. But have you ever considered asking the question, maybe that's not God's call for me? And I've said this before when it comes to Westside Church. 95% of you will not be able to afford to live on the West Side, right? Or if you do, you're going to live with 12 people in a cubicle, right? And spend $600,000 for that with $800 a month in strata fees, right? That's the West Side. So most of you are going to move. And that's good. If you can move and that's what you feel God is calling you to do, great. But what happens if God has called you to stay here? To give yourself to something bigger than just you and your plans. What happens if he's called you to live in a place that you never own? With no backyard. Because God has called you to be a missionary in Vancouver and we need Christians to stay here. What happens if he's called you to that? And maybe he hasn't. But we conform so much to this world if we don't even at least consider, maybe that's what he's called me to. That's conformity. That's conformity. It's not whether you drink a beer or get a tattoo, and I know I'm going to get emails. Every time I say that, I get emails. All right? Email me, and I won't reply to you. All right? I shouldn't have said that. Oh, man, that's terrible. That's terrible. I know there's a verse in Leviticus. I've read the verse, right? Where are we? Let's move on. Let's just stop there. Right. Let's close this up because we need to worship more and get me off the stage. Let me close off by saying this. That third point was we need to defer to God's will as we plan. And then the last point that James makes here in verses 16 and 17 is we need to honor God's holiness as we plan. Look at verses 16 and 17 as we close this. It says, ah, it is. You boast and brag, All such boasting is evil. Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins. We need to honor God's holiness as we plan. Quite simply, planning our life without God is a sin. And the reason why that is because to not submit to the plan and will of God is to make us, you, me, the God of our lives. And that in Scripture is called idolatry. That sort of planning can be titled arrogant, foolish, and it's the worst sort of bravado. Jeremiah 9, 23 and 24 puts it this way, let not a wise man boast in his wisdom, let not the mighty boast of his might. Let not a rich man boast of his riches, But let him who boast of this. This is so good that he understands and knows me. Ah, that's good. As we conclude, let me just share one more parable. I'll turn there. Luke, great parable. Concerning parable, sobering parable. It's a parable I refer to a lot just in terms of how we do ministry here at Westside. I repeat it every once in a while when it comes to what I believe God is calling us to. But in Luke chapter 12, Jesus says this. He told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich towards God." I guess I close this way by asking a couple simple questions. Have you been running on your own strength? Did you spend all of last year just running on your own strength? Have you spent your life running on your own strength? Have you been relying on your own wisdom? Have you been seeking your own riches, thinking that that will take care of all your problems? Do you desire to know the will of God, but God seems quiet? My question to you may be, are you presenting your bodies as living sacrifices to him? When you do that, you will know the will of God, his good and pleasing and perfect will. It's a promise. If it wasn't true, God would be a liar. It's a promise. So as we come now and respond in worship and in prayer and in communion, we come, and I encourage you to come as living sacrifices. And there is no greater picture of God's mercy than the bread and the wine. So we come and we celebrate, and my encouragement is if you have not looked forward to this year as an opportunity for you to bring glory to Jesus, come forward.